It is Wednesday, September 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, forecasters warn about the dangers of Hurricane Florence.
It's very strong, and more importantly, one of the things that worries me is that it's going to stall or slow down some right near the coast.
The United States says the Saudi Arabian coalition is taking enough steps to prevent civilian deaths in Yemen, and we get some perspective on the various scandals surrounding the Trump White House. It's all ahead. Millions of residents along the southeastern U.S. Atlantic coast are being urged to finish preparations ahead of Hurricane Florence. The storm is expected to make landfall later this week, unleashing damaging winds and life-threatening amounts of rain. Florence is a Category 4 storm with maximum sustained winds of 215 kilometers per hour. Forecasters do not expect Florence's strength to change much before it comes ashore near the North Carolina-South Carolina border. Mandatory evacuations in many affected areas have left highways packed with traffic as residents head inland. Marshall Shepard is a professor at the University of Georgia's Geography Department, director of the university's Atmospheric Sciences Program, and the former president of the American Meteorological Society. He tells me about the unique qualities of Hurricane Florence.
This hurricane is very difficult for us as meteorologists. I tweeted earlier that I've never seen anything like it in my 25 years as a meteorologist at NASA and now a professor at the University of Georgia. First of all, it's a fairly intense storm at a fairly high latitude, fairly north of the tropics. We typically don't see Cat 4, Cat 5 storms headed toward North Carolina. But recently, in the last 24 hours, the models have projected out a track forecast that's really unique. Many of us in our field have just not seen it. The model is bringing it into or very close to North Carolina-South Carolina border and then shoving it down the coastline in the South Carolina and perhaps in the Georgia. That's very odd, but the steering currents are weak once the storm gets close to land, so it's not surprising if you think about what happens with a child's spin toy. You spin it around, it sits there and wobbles a while until something pushes it away.
I guess the last really powerful hurricane that hit in that particular area was Hurricane Hugo back in 1989?
I would say that Floyd and Matthew were pretty significant storms as well. Hurricane Matthew caused quite a bit of flooding in 2016 in parts of North Carolina. It came up from Florida. It certainly had weakened by the time it got to North Carolina some, but still was a significant hazard. But sure, Hurricane Hugo, in many people's mind, is the signature hurricane in the last 25, 30 years or so for that region. But I always caution against comparing storms. I mean, I've heard someone say, well, I rode out Hugo. I'll be fine here. Every storm's different, and this one's very different from even Hugo.
What is the anticipated danger level to the population in this area as this, you know, hurricane approaches?
I think it's the highest level of danger I've seen with a storm. There are only certain storms that would make me say that. Storms like Maria approaching Puerto Rico, Katrina approaching New Orleans. I think this falls into that category because of the sheer size of the storm. It's physically huge. If you've seen satellite imagery, it's very strong. And more importantly, one of the things that worries me is that it's going to stall or slow down some right near the coast. And so there will be prolonged hours of rain, extreme winds, storm surge, and inland flooding and coastal flooding. So this is going to be perhaps a 1-2-3 punch, and it's not just going to come happen and move out. It may be a few days before we get rid of it.
I know you don't like comparing hurricanes, but I do remember that with Hurricane Harvey, that was also predicted to, you know, stall and linger.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I talked about Harvey last year, and I think sometimes the public struggles with the fact that you've got this 1-2 punch. I think people are very familiar with what happens to a storm when it makes landfall, very strong wind, storm surge, but that secondary part, that lingering around and producing days and days of rain and flooding, that's a bit more difficult for people to grasp the significant hazard associated with that. So, yeah, I think this is very Harvey-esque, but maybe actually in some ways a bit stronger and larger storm.
Well, authorities have called on people that are in the area that affected to evacuate. Is that something then you would agree with?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm always from the better safe than sorry school of camp. I don't mind being inconvenienced even if ultimately nothing happens. But I think in this case, with the size of the storm, you can't focus on exactly where it's going to make landfall because it's so big and has widespread impact. So I think responsible evacuation. And honestly, I think as I mentioned, there's been a recent sort of nudge or shift in the track that brings South Carolina and Georgia more into play a little bit. I think people in those areas have to kind of put their guard up as well, because perhaps many of them had written it off as, oh, it's going into North Carolina, I don't have anything to worry about. I think anywhere from Virginia to the Georgia coastline needs to be on alert and starting to make preparations, because this thing is big and it's powerful.
Well, I'm here in D.C. right above Virginia, so anyway.
Yeah, I'd say what I mean by Virginia is primarily the southern Virginia coastline areas. Not so much, I think the D.C. area will perhaps feel some residual rain or perhaps, but I think we're talking more about coastal Virginia southward down into South Georgia and perhaps parts of North Florida. But it's a storm to be reckoned with, and I think that I'm a little concerned, because one of the things that I always see is that people will see a forecast and say, oh, that's it. But with meteorological forecasts, you've got to watch the evolving forecast, because with these things, there can be changes. So people tend to kind of see what they saw on Monday and say, oh, that's what's going to happen. But with a storm like this, you've got to watch how it's evolving.
Marshall Shepard, professor at the University of Georgia's Geography Department. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. European Union lawmakers vote to sanction Hungary for eroding democratic values. Pope Francis summons bishops for a sex abuse summit. Russian President Vladimir Putin says there's nothing criminal about two poisoning suspects, and the two Koreas will open a joint liaison office on Friday. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Jupiter Trojans are asteroids found in two large swarms that circle the Sun in the same orbit as the planet Jupiter. Among them is the Patroclus and Minucius binary asteroid system, which is a pair of asteroids that circle each other as they orbit the Sun. After studying the system, scientists at the Southwest Research Institute have found that their existence suggests a battle between the gas giants Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune within the first 100 million years of our solar system's history. The scientists say this skirmish pushed Uranus and Neptune outward, where they interacted with small objects in what today is known as the Kuiper Belt. David Nesvorny, lead author of a study that details the group's findings, says this interaction pushed a number of these objects inward, with a few becoming trapped as Trojan asteroids. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at concerns regarding the humanitarian cost of a Syrian assault on northwest Idlib province. The United States says it is determined that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are taking sufficient steps to prevent civilian destruction in Yemen, where Saudi coalition airstrikes have killed thousands of civilians. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Wednesday sent a letter to Congress certifying that the Saudi coalition is taking demonstrable actions to reduce civilian casualties and destruction. I asked VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain what evidence Pompeo cited.
Well, Sarah, he really does not elaborate very much in the statement. I have it in front of me here, and he says that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are undertaking demonstrable actions to reduce the risk of harm to civilians and civilian infrastructure resulting from the military actions of those governments. But he does not elaborate, except he has tweeted out that ending the civil war in Yemen is a national security priority for the United States, and that the U.S. will continue to call on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to work with the UN-backed peace process. There have been attempts at peace talks in Geneva and so on. But besides that, exactly these demonstrable actions are, we don't have any details on that yet.
Now, Congress had given Pompeo until today, until September 12th, to certify that the coalition is taking steps to reduce civilian deaths. What are some of the concerns by members of Congress regarding this whole issue?
Right. Members of Congress have just been very disturbed. We saw in August two separate incidents, one on a bombing by the Saudi-led coalition of a bus of young boys who had been on a picnic field trip and with at least 40 children killed. And this has just, these horrible pictures of the aftermath of that bus bombing really stirred people up in Congress. And some members are even calling for the U.S. to end its role there. And others, like Democratic Senator Shaheen and Republican Senator Young, are calling on the U.S. to use its leverage over Saudi Arabia to say, look, you know, this has been going on now for 3 years, and why are these so-called errant bombings still happening? Calling on the U.S. to use its leverage to really put pressure on Saudi Arabia to stop these kind of things from happening.
But it seems as though the Trump administration is unlikely to end its military support for Saudi Arabia.
That's right, Sarah. The analysts that I have spoken to say, you know, this actually started under the Obama administration and it continues now. And with the Trump administration being very close to Saudi Arabia and agreeing, I guess, with the Saudis that the main focus in the Middle East is the danger and the threat posed by Iran. And of course, with Iran supporting the Houthi rebels, which are the other party to this conflict against the Saudi-led coalition, it does not look likely. And it seems that the American public has been distracted with so many other issues going on in North Korea and so on, that they have not as yet been paying that much attention to this terrible war in Yemen.
VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain. There's growing concern about the humanitarian cost of a Russia-backed Syrian assault on northwest Idlib province, the last major bastion of jihadist opposition to the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Turkey, which borders Idlib and already hosts nearly 3 million Syrian refugees, has called for a ceasefire. Russia, meanwhile, called on Turkey to avoid military action by separating moderate elements of the opposition in Idlib from more radical fighters. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Tuesday Iran, Russia, and Syria, guarantors in the so-called Astana process to end the violence, must find a way that keeps civilians from paying the price to resolve Idlib.
It is absolutely essential to avoid a full-scale battle in Idlib. This would unleash a humanitarian nightmare unlike any seen in the blood-soaked Syrian conflict. Almost half of Idlib's population of 2.9 million people have gone there to seek refuge from conflict elsewhere in Syria. They include close to 1 million children, and their lives have been upended, and they have nowhere to go. Idlib is the last so-called de-escalation zone in Syria. It must not be transformed into a bloodbath. I understand that the present situation in Idlib is not sustainable, and the presence of terrorist groups cannot be tolerated. But fighting terrorism does not absolve warring parties of their core obligations under international law. I make a clear appeal to all parties directly and indirectly involved, and in particular the three guarantors of the de-escalation zone, namely Iran, Russia, and Turkey, spare no effort to find solutions that protect civilians, preserve basic services and hospitals, ensure full respect for international humanitarian law.
Guterres said there's no military solution in Syria. It must be political. Anthony Billingsley is a senior lecturer in Middle East politics and international law at Australia's University of New South Wales. He tells International Edition's Victor Beattie, while the pursuit of a military solution is an appalling prospect, the position of the Syrian government against the terrorist threat is understandable.
Yes, there are 3 million people or thereabouts trapped in the area. But there's something like, well, I've seen one figure of 70,000 fighters, including 10,000 Al-Qaeda fighters. And the Al-Qaeda fighters have for many years now dominated the opposition in Syria. So you've got a very formidable force resisting the Syrian government, and one that has the potential to challenge the regime. So I think the regime is saying, we must end this. And I think also they regard the opposition, the Al-Qaeda ones especially, as people who are willing to take everyone else down with them. So you've got this appalling sort of catch-22 in a way with the fighters in Idlib. At the same time, I think the Turks' position is, well, I suppose in practical terms, it might be beneficial in that they're calling for a ceasefire and a political solution. But I think their main concern there is to preserve the sort of protectorate that they've established in the north of the country and to maintain their links with a lot of the insurgent groups in Idlib and further north.
The French foreign minister had an interesting take. He warned that a Syrian offensive could scatter thousands of foreign jihadists overseas.
That's, of course, something that everybody is concerned about. I mean, Australia, for example, has people who've gone over and fought in Syria, and the Brits and everybody else. From an outsider's point of view, putting aside the humanitarian horror of this whole thing, what do we expect the Syrian government to do? Do we sort of just say, well, look, we'll just put a cordon sanitaire around the Idlib province and just leave it? If you're the government of a country, you want to be in control of the full country. Otherwise, your power is always going to be under question. And there's a very deep personal animosity between the two sides, which have built up over the years as well.
Is it possible to reach some sort of compromise that forestalls an offensive, provides some sort of open space to allow the tens of thousands of jihadist fighters to leave Syria?
Guterres has proposed areas for people to escape from the fighting. Where, for example, would they allow the fighters to go? The conclusion is, yes, we could allow civilians to go out through some escape route, but I think the idea of letting the jihadis out, from the Syrian government's point of view, why would you bother? We are winning, we are in control here, we have the Russian support, we just ignore everybody else.
Anthony Billingsley, a senior lecturer at Australia's University of New South Wales. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. The Trump White House has been, by many accounts, in chaos with a recent opinion article published in the New York Times from an anonymous senior staffer and a just-released book by a highly acclaimed journalist. Investigative journalist Bob Woodward's Fear, Trump in the White House, is a highly critical look at Trump's 20-month presidency. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Jeremy Meyer, associate professor in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. She asked him to give us his take on all that's been happening.
We've seen a lot of unprecedented things happen both during the Trump campaign and during the Trump presidency, but this week and this two-week period have been sort of the apex of unprecedented. First of all, you don't have, in the history of the American presidency going back to Washington, a situation where an inside the White House, a top administration official, writes an anonymous account about how the president is unhinged, about how members of his own staff are actively thwarting him because they believe him to be unstable. That alone would be unbelievable. But then to have that happen, along with the release of a Bob Woodward book that essentially says the same thing, with greater detail and greater depth and greater sourcing. Bob Woodward occupies kind of a special place within American presidential studies and journalism. He's written about 9 presidents, which is 20% of all the presidents America's ever had. And he is widely regarded as the dean of American presidential journalism. Credibility almost unimpeachable, to make a witticism. To have him go after Trump in this level of detail and then have the op-ed is just a very bad week for any White House. But then the Gallup numbers for Trump mm-hmm. came out again this week, mm-hmm. and he's around 35%, 34%, with an economy that is really doing quite well by the macroeconomic numbers of inflation, unemployment, and GDP growth. We've had recent presidents that have never once been that low, and Trump's been at this level several times in his first 2 years. So this has been a very, very bad week for the president.
You know, that book also describes moments when staff members, according to Woodward, joined together to block what they believed were the president's most dangerous impulses, sometimes removing papers from the president's desk.
So many things are not normal about President Trump. Like, for example, some people were a little bit disturbed by his tweeting such unpresidential things on 9/11's anniversary. But this is who Donald Trump is, and a lot of people like him for it. He's very informal. He violates norms all the time. And if you remember, on 9/11, he gave a 10-minute interview. And during that interview, as just a businessman and a prominent political wannabe, he found the time to say, the building I own at 40 Wall Street is now the tallest one in downtown Manhattan, which is such a self-aggrandizing, narcissistic thing to say, as what we thought might have been 10,000 Americans had been blown to bits in these two towers. Trump found a moment to say, hey, my building's the tallest now in downtown Manhattan, and that's the man we elected.
What happens in a situation that we've never really dealt with before when you've got the staff of a president going behind his back, warning the American people? What happens in a situation like this? The president's calling this a bunch of lies, and the staffers are coming out publicly and denying any of the comments that were associated with them in the book. Where does that leave the country?
Well, I think that there's very little that the average citizen can do. This is really a moment when we look to other institutions set up by the founders to address malfeasance or misconduct in the White House by the president. If there were any normal Republican majority in the Congress, this would be investigated. This would be a subject of oversight. And yet not a single Republican, as far as I'm aware of, stepped forward to say, hey, the thing said in Woodward's book or raised in this op-ed deserve a hearing, not even a hearing. And because the Democrats are not in charge of either House of Congress, they have no ability to launch hearings.
Is it possible that these people that are denying it are telling the truth, or is it more than likely they're protecting their jobs?
Well, I'm sure most of them are telling the truth in the sense that most of them didn't write the op-ed, and that's how they're limited. The very few of them are refuting the facts. They're not being specific in their denials.
Mm-hmm.
What may be of concern is that did the anonymous writer of the op-ed help his cause? He said, or she said, her purpose was to reassure the American people that there were adults in the room, that our president may be immature, but there are people working tirelessly to make sure America's interests are upheld. But if we didn't know that, would we be better off? Because what this has done is clearly enraged the president. The president is justly angered. Any president would be angered. But what is unusual, I think, is that if this had happened to Obama, he would have had self-control. He would have managed to work with his staff to quietly find the person. Here, it's eruption after Trump eruption.
And is there anything he can do? You know, he's called for his Justice Department to look into this, investigate these people. Who wrote the op-ed? He called it a matter of national security. Is there any legal precedent for that?
No, there really isn't. You can't make it illegal to be unhappy at your job at the White House. The fact that the Justice Department has not responded to the president is evidence that that idea is going nowhere. What is going to happen is an internal investigation, which would happen at any White House. You know, there were leaks in the Obama White House that bothered the president. Every White House, every chief of staff struggles to fight leaks. The Trump administration is different. I've never seen leaking like this in all the time I've been studying White House. This White House has a meeting, a secret meeting to fight leaks, and within a day, the meeting to fight leaks is leaked. There's very little trust and loyalty within this team.
Jeremy Meyer, Associate Professor of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.